from KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, an hour with Marty Grothy, in which we discuss if-erisms. If it bleeds, it leads. If the shoe fits, wear it. If you've seen one, you've seen them all. If you can't be good, be careful. Why do so many aphoristic pieces of wisdom begin with the word if? And what do they tell us? And where do they lead us? If you want to find out, listen to the hour ahead. If you want to join in, you can call or email. If all goes well, Forum is next. If all goes as planned, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. An aphorism is a brief observation that tries to communicate some kind of truth about the human experience. And Marty Grothy tells us there are five laws for aphorisms. They have to be brief, definitive, personal, philosophical, and have a twist. Dr. Marty Grothy, who has a PhD in psychology and is a management consultant, is really in many ways a collector of language and words. He's the author of a number of books. I Never Metaphor I Didn't Like, a comprehensive compilation of history's greatest analogies, metaphors, and similes, and Viva la Repartee, which is an anthology of clever comebacks and witty remarks, and Oxymoronica, which is a book celebrating oxymorons, and his most recent book is Iforisms, an anthology of aphorisms that begin with the word if, and our popular culture is replete with iforisms. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. If life hands you lemons, make lemonade. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Marty Grothy, the maven of iforisms, joins us this forum hour. He's with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. We welcome you to the program. Good to have you back.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
Okay. And pleased you're here. And why a book on iforisms?
Well, this is my fifth book, which are essentially compilations of quotations. And I've been collecting quotations for almost 50 years. About 20 years ago, I noticed that a lot of the quotations in my personal collection began with the word if. It was just a little thing I noticed, and I actually created a separate file. I called it my iffy file at the time. And as the years went by, I wrote some other books, and after my last book, I was toying around with, well, what's the next book I'm going to write? And I went back through my iffy file, and I actually kind of surprised myself because I've been slowly adding quotations that begin with the word if to it for the last 20 years, and it almost blew my mind when I kind of delved back into it and saw this tremendous number of really remarkable observations, and I knew right then and there that was going to be my next book.
Well, if your mind could have literally been blown, it would have been, because
indeed.
Mine may have been too by this. What we get into here, though, it's fascinating in many ways. Some of it is, well, let me talk about some funny things first. One that made me laugh out loud. You talk about counterfactual uses of if, and this was an example when Mikhail Gorbachev back in the 80s, because of Glasnost, saw that things were opening and a Western reporter came to him and said, a question from left field at best, what effect on history do you think it would have made if in 1963 Chairman Khrushchev had been assassinated instead of President Kennedy? What an if. And his response was, I don't think Mr. Onassis would have married Mrs. Khrushchev, which, as I said, made me laugh out loud. But that's a specific example of what you call counterfactual thinking.
Well, there's three kinds of types of iforisms that I talk about in the book. One is called counterfactual thinking, and that's when we imagine how things would be if some aspect of the past were changed. And, you know, whenever people say things like, well, if Kennedy hadn't been assassinated, what would the world be like today? Or if Britain had won the Revolutionary War, what would be things like today? Those are examples of counterfactual thinking.
And you've also got hypothetical thinking, such as Gloria Steinem, the example that you use, which also is pretty funny.
Well, it is. But before we get to that, you know, Aristotle said that the mark of an intelligent person was to be able to entertain an idea without actually believing it. And this is what people do when they engage in hypothetical thinking. If you look up the word hypothesis in the dictionary, it will say that it's something taken to be true for purposes of argument or investigation. And this is exactly what Gloria Steinem did in 1978 when she wrote an article in Ms. Magazine. The hypothesis that she entertained shows up in the title, and it was called If Men Could Menstruate, A Political Fantasy. Now, that's a really intriguing hypothetical question. You know, what would things be like if instead of women, it were men that had periods? Well, she poses this hypothetical question, and then she answers it in the most fascinating way. She says...
Very funny way, too.
Oh, absolutely. Can I read the whole thing?
Sure.
She says, what would happen if suddenly, magically, men could menstruate and women could not? And then she writes, the answer is clear. Menstruation would become an enviable, boastworthy, masculine event. She goes on to talk more about it, but she ends by talking about how we would have now Paul Newman tampons and men bragging about how long they menstruated or saying things like, I'm a three-pad man. And that's all as a result of posing this fascinating hypothetical question. And that's something that human beings uniquely can do.
It's also where fiction comes from, you know, as if. And so much of this has to do with just conditional and what might be and what might have been. In fact, there's some fascinating examples historically that you managed to call, one of them having to do with the origin of brinksmanship, which goes back to, I didn't know, John Foster Dulles, and the origin of if anything can go wrong at will, which is Murphy's Law, which actually goes back to a captain named Edward Murphy who was out here at Edwards Air Force Base. These things have real origins.
Well, one of the things that's always fascinated me is, you know, I've been a quotation collector for many decades. But if you just go into the average quotation book, what happens is that even if there's lots of delicious quotations, if you go through them one after another, after another, after another, sometimes it can get a little tedious. So what I've tried to do in all of my books now is every now and then tell the story behind the quote. And I certainly do that with Murphy's Law. I certainly do it with that Dulles quote about brinksmanship. I try to do it, you know, in a way that makes the experience of reading this book stimulating in some other ways that you might not find in a typical quotation book.
Do we know where the aphorism, if ifs were ifs and buts were buts, comes from?
That's an old English saying. So many of these wonderful aphorisms from the past, like that one, or if wishes were horses, beggars would ride. These are the original authors are lost to history. We now just call them proverbial quotations.
But let's give a little bit of sprinkling here and examples from the book. Marc Chagall said, if I create from the heart, nearly everything works. If from the head, almost nothing. And Clarence Darrow, if you lose the power to laugh, you lose the power to think. Mother Teresa, if you can't feed 100 people, then feed just one. And Catherine Hepburn, if you obey all the rules, you miss all the fun. I mean, you've got such a range of people here, famous people here from all walks of life, and the diversity itself is really breathtaking to behold.
Well, thank you.
The Kipling poem, though, I was struck by because there's a lot of wisdom and a lot that people derive out of these kind of aphorisms.
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead, and let's talk about that. Yeah.
Well, you know, in 1896, Rudyard Kipling wrote a poem called If, and it was a 32-line poem consisting of a whole bunch of phrases that began with the word if. It actually didn't get published until 1910. So interestingly, this year we are celebrating the 100th anniversary of Kipling's famous poem, and many, many, many people have described this as the most famous poem in history. All of your listeners will be familiar with the first line, if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. And then he goes on with a number of other really interesting aphorisms. And in fact, if you ever go to Wimbledon to watch the tennis games being played, at the gateway into center court is another passage from that poem. And this is from memory. I think I got it right. If you can meet triumph and disaster and treat both of these imposters just the same. So this is a wonderful poem. And you know, with so many of these great quotations, they're often used so often they become parodied over time. And there's a wonderful parody of the first line of Kipling's poem that the humorist Jean Kerr offered in her Please Don't Eat the Daisies book. This goes back to 1958. You probably are familiar with this. She said, "If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs, it's just possible you haven't grasped the situation."
Yeah, and then there's all that parodying of "if at first you can't succeed, try, try."
Oh, absolutely. There's a bundle of those. I think my favorite is Quentin Crisp, I think, said this: if at first you can't succeed, then failure may be your style.
There's so many funny ones like that, too. I, for example, have to bring up Rodney Dangerfield, who said, "If it weren't for pickpockets, I'd have no sex life at all." and I guess, you know, this, of course, depends on how it's delivered. But the inimitable Henny Youngman, who said, "If I want to see a baseball game in the worst way, if you want to see a baseball game in the worst way, take your wife along."
That's right. He got inspired, I think, for that line from Sam Levinson, who said, "If your wife wants to learn how to drive, don't stand in her way."
By the way, your dedication is one of the sweetest I've ever seen to your wife.
Oh,
if I could change one thing about her, I wouldn't. How many married people can say that?
Well, and I actually believe that.
Let's talk about if-erisms, though, in the political sphere. I mean, you talk about the Obama speech, and you talk about Martin Luther King speeches. And, well, first, Obama at one point early on said, if one voice can change the room, then it can change a city, and then he went on to a nation and a globe and so forth. And this became, in some ways, almost emblematic of his campaign, again, beginning with that dream, that notion of a dream. And then you have King, of course. Well, I had a dream, but also, if you don't stand for something, you will fall for anything.
Yes.
And tell the story, if you would, also, because it's such a poignant story about "If I Had Sneezed," Martin Luther King.
Well, this is something I really didn't know until I got into the book, but maybe 10 years before he gave that speech, he was doing, I think, a book signing in Harlem, and a deranged fan stabbed him in the neck with a letter opener. And it was a chilling sight, apparently, and he was rushed to the hospital. And later on, I think it was in his autobiography he was writing, or I can't recall exactly where it was, he talks about how the surgeons told him that the blade of the letter opener was so close to the aorta that if it had just been a quarter of an inch different, he would have bled to death. And there's a wonderful passage that I quote in the book where how he talks about if I had sneezed, because if he had sneezed, what would have happened is that the aorta would have been ruptured and he would have been dead. And he, just like Obama did in his speech, he uses the familiar oratorical device of repetition. So he says, if I had sneezed, and then he mentions something, and then if I had sneezed, I would not have been in Birmingham to help lead the bus strike. And if I had sneezed, I would not have been in Washington to tell the nation about a dream I had had. It's a powerful passage, but what makes it most interesting is to learn also the story behind it.
So as long as we're talking about notable African-Americans, I was curious to learn that something I'd always associated with Eldridge Cleaver, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem, actually, I learned from you, goes to George Carlin, not to Eldridge Cleaver.
So many quotations get changed over the course of time. I think you're misreading that, though, Michael. Carlin actually parodied the line. Because if memory serves for me, Cleaver was responsible for saying, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And I think it was Carlin's parody that said, if you think you're part of the solution, you are the problem.
But it came after Cleaver, in other words.
Yeah. Oh, it came well after him. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, that makes more sense. I thought for some reason it had led to Cleaver's quote or had been before.
No. That Cleaver quote obviously occurred back in the late 1960s, and it became, as so many of these wonderful quotations do, just part of popular culture. What happens is we kind of forget the original author of them, and then they just pass into popular usage. And then when they become so popular, that's when the wits and the wags and the wordsmiths take over and begin to do their parodies.
Yeah, in fact, if it ain't broke, don't fix it is a splendid example. I didn't know it came from Burt Lentz, and yet it's so much a part of popular culture now.
I know. Isn't that fascinating? I mean, nobody had ever heard that. Burt Lentz was
Jimmy Carter's
yeah. budget officer, I think he was. And he used that wonderful expression, and it became almost immediately so popular that everybody called it like a modern proverb. But he was the guy that first said it.
So we learn a great deal here, and what I find myself sort of asking is, I mean, you've done all these books on oxymorons, you've done books on metaphors and so forth. Where do you – is there any thing that really offers more distilled wisdom or, forgive me, contributes in a particularly singularly different way to the popular culture?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Can you repeat that for me?
In other words, when we look at oxymorons, when we look at aphorisms, when we look at similes and metaphors and so forth, and so many of them do become part of the popular culture, and so many of them have this sense of crystallized or distilled wisdom in that. Is there something about one of the forms that particularly ought to stand out against the others?
Well, George Orwell that said words are the most powerful drug used by mankind. And of course, that's a metaphor. But I think we can just use that as a starting off point to talk about why, you know, all of these collections of great quotations are kind of fascinating because, you know, all a great quotation is, after all, is an idea embedded in a bundle of words. And great ideas that are phrased in these pithy, succinct ways sometimes just, you know, capture our imagination. I mean, they're all, generically speaking, they're all aphorisms. Taylor Coleridge once said that the largest portion of our knowledge consists of aphorisms. And when people talk about any book that has moved them or changed them or altered their lives, it's not the book that's changed their lives. It's passages from the book. When people talk about, you know, the Bible, it's passages like, and these are aphorisms now, if a house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand. So these beautifully expressed quotations or observations about eternal truths are the things that we take with us and that help us to kind of get through each and every day.
That's well said. I think there's a different response that we have, though, to an aphorism than we have. I was looking through your books. I was looking through your oxymoron book and love some of those. Degas saying painting is easy when you don't know how, but very difficult when you do. Or Bernadette Devlin, free love is too expensive. Ava Gardner, I'm deeply superficial. These things are all oxymoronic, and they kind of have a different effect on you, just like all of the collection of repartee remarks that you have a sort of different effect on me. When Truman Capote died and Gore Vidal said, good career move, for example. I mean,
yes.
You know, these are things that have a different twist than, let's say, an aphorism has or an oxymoron has.
Oh, interesting. Well, I'm not sure exactly why this is true, but I think one of the reasons that we're drawn to aphorisms is that they pose these imagined scenarios in our minds that we can begin to kind of think about. Again, going back to Samuel Taylor Coleridge, he said, if men could learn from history, what lessons it might teach us. Well, I mean, that, you know, dozen words there expresses one of the great truths about the human experience, and it happens to be expressed in this aphoristic fashion. But, you know, one of the things that we find about aphorisms in general is that they are very audacious. There's a Ukrainian writer, I can't recall his name right now, he said an aphorism is a one-line novel. And I think that really kind of captures what these aphorisms try to do. They try to express great truths in a very, very, very few a number of words.
And some of them have particular relevance to the time. For example, early on in your book of aphorisms, you mentioned Stephen Stills, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with.
Yeah.
And that kind of embodies a certain period in American popular culture, just like the classic statement of Truman's, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen, continues to be something that is pulled back over and over again by politicians in different times. I mean, some of these, in other words, seem almost time-specific and yet live on in spite of themselves, and some of them are definitely not time-specific.
Oh, indeed. And going to that Truman quote, what's fascinating about that one is Truman never said that. I mean,
yeah,
everybody
right.
quotes him as saying that. But, you know, what happened was there was a Broadway play, I can't remember exactly the year, about Harry Truman's life. I think the title was called Give 'Em Hell, Harry. And I believe James Whitmore played the role of Truman in that
That's
production.
Right.
And he was the guy that said, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. We just thought it sounded so much like Harry Truman that now almost everybody says that's a Truman quote, when in fact it was really authored by the person who wrote the play.
So you have to do a lot of research on these quotes. I mean, it's easy enough to get etymological data about words. You go to the OED. Where do you go to look for these kind of aphorisms origins?
Well, you know, as I mentioned before, I've been doing this for many, many, many decades, and there's just nothing that gives me a greater thrill than finding a quotation that I've never seen before and that maybe most other people aren't familiar with, and I can kind of bring it out of the closet of obscurity and share it with others. Another great thrill for me is finding, you know, something out about a quotation or the author that is not well known. And, you know, I'm a voracious reader. I have probably 300 quotation books in my personal library, but I'm also one of those millions of people who have now found the internet and the World Wide Web to be just a grand source of digging much, much deeper into the history behind some of these quotes.
Well, let me give you a couple here to consider before we go to the break. Here's Emily Dickinson, who said, if I read a book and it makes my whole body so cold, no fire can ever warm me, I know that is poetry. If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that is poetry.
Mm.
And just sort of in the literary vein, if you will, Faulkner said,
yep.
If a writer has to rob his mother, he will not hesitate. The ode on a Grecian urn is worth any number of old ladies. I remember that was said in an interview with George Plimpton in the Paris Review.
Indeed.
And
yep.
Some of you may have some favorite aphorisms. If you want to talk about them or find the origins to them, you've come to the right place here this hour, because we've got Marty Grothy with us, who's written the book Aphorisms, an anthology of aphorisms that began with the word if. And Rita Mae Brown is on the cover of the book. If the world were a logical place, men would ride side saddle. You may want to join us, and feel free, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, to do that. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. We welcome your contributions and involvement in the program. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, and you can also leave questions and comments on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment.
That's the way I just gotta behave. Boy, if I were a lamp, I'd light. Or if I were a banner, I'd wave. Ask me how do I feel, little me, with my quiet upbringing.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Dr. Marty Grothy, who is the author of a book called Iforisms. It's an anthology of aphorisms that begin with the word if. He's also the author of I Never Met a Four I Didn't Like and Oxymoronica. And by the way, since we're talking about language, on Tuesday next week, we're going to talk to the editors of a book of six-word memoirs from figures both famous and obscure. And we'd like to hear from you about this. How would you sum up your life in six words? It's a real challenge. Think about it. For an example, and to share your six-word memoir, simply visit kqed.org/forum. And again, we welcome your contributions along those lines. Kevin Guillory, one of our producers, just reminded me, and it's in Marty Grothy's book, If the Glove Doesn't Fit, You Must Acquit. I mean, there are famous aphorisms like that. I was thinking about some of my favorite aphorisms, and some of you may want to contribute yours. I like John Wooden's line, which is a certain type of aphorism. It comes from repetition of a word in a newer, more specific way. If I am through learning, I am through. Yes. And I like that the line that's also in the book, Aphorisms, from the Talmud, if you add to the truth, you subtract from it. These are, I mean, there really is a good deal of wisdom that one can glean from these. Let me go to our callers and find out what they have to say. From San Francisco, Robert, good morning.
Okay, good morning. My German uncle used to say, if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be an omnibus.
I think that's in the book, isn't it, Martin?
Well,
or something like
actually,
that. Yeah.
There's actually kind of a R-rated version,
exactly.
But it makes the same point.
It doesn't necessarily go back to Germany. Do we know the origins of that?
No, we do not. But it goes back to Europe. There's no question. And but it's the basic notion that your aunt could be your uncle if a certain physiological fact were different.
Anatomical difference, yeah.
Anatomical difference.
Correct. Richard, join us. You're on. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. Another fantastic program. A favorite, lovely subject. This is from the study of flowing dragon swords. It's an aphorism, and it says, if divine nature had meant for us to figure life out by ourselves, we all would have been put on our own planets.
Ooh, isn't that interesting?
This is the first time you heard that, Marty?
It is, yeah. I mean, this happens every time I do an interview. Somebody brings up a quotation I've never heard. And if I may...
if you may.
This will get, if I may, I have a website, www.drmardy.com, and D-R-M-A-R-D is the middle portion. I would love for this gentleman, as well as any other of your listeners, if they've got a really wonderful aphorism, come up to my website. There's a link that you can click to send it to me. I would especially like to have that one. I'm not familiar with it, and I'd love to do some more research on it.
Here's one I've not heard. I don't know if you had. Mark writes, in chemistry, we say if you are not part of the solution, you are precipitate. Pretty good.
Another parody.
Yeah. They're endless. Let's go to our caller, San Jose. Mark, hi. Another Mark. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm a linguist, and I'm naturally interested in these aphorisms. But I'm wondering, is there something we can learn from this? For example, if I knew then what I know now, it kind of, to me, implies that we should be careful and that also that there's nothing we can do about the now. Are all these aphorisms good or bad, or what's the great message we can take from this? Because I'm sure it's not just for fun and that there's some learning involved. For example, metaphor enables us to understand the abstract in simple terms. What are the functions of this? Are they good or bad?
Well, that was a little bit what I was getting at before, but Marty Grothy, what do you say about that?
Well, I think the functions are mainly good. I'm struggling now to think about how they might be bad. But if I knew then what I know now, how would I have behaved differently is just a kind of a formulation of what-if thinking that people engage in all the time. And it's the capacity that human beings have to reflect upon their life and to imagine what would life be in the future if things were different now, or what would my present circumstance be like if things in the past had been different? I think it just reflects the wonderful, marvelous human capacity to be able to step outside of ourselves and to imagine how things might have been different if certain other conditions were different.
Of course, in some instances, like with cliches, you can take these things too far and make them apply when they don't apply or think that they
have universality
when they don't. If you can't be good, be careful. If you've got it, flaunt it. If you've seen one, you've seen them all. I mean, there are so many like that that are catchy and that capture our attention, but that don't necessarily.
Those are catchy, but
they're classic.
They're light.
They're platitudes, really, aren't they?
I gravitate more towards the thought-provoking ones. When Abraham Maslow said, "If the only tool you have is a hammer, you tend to see every problem as a nail," you know, he captured beautifully there, the notion of the danger of what happens when you're a person of only one idea.
Yeah, I also like the Aaron Copland quote, "If a literary man puts together two words about music, one of them will be wrong."
Oh, indeed. Do you remember Viktor Frankl when he wrote the book about Man's Search for Meaning?
Yeah, right.
You know, Viktor Frankl was an Austrian psychiatrist, and he said that the quotation that helped get him through his several years in a concentration camp was a wonderful observation from Friedrich Nietzsche, who said, "If we have a why of life, we can endure almost any how." Now, that's powerful, in my opinion.
Let me go to more of our calls. From Fairfax, Kurt, you're on.
Hi, thanks. My aphorism is one that I heard in a song. I don't know if that's the origin of it, but the aphorism is, "If the day is short, make it wide," which I think, characterizes the idea that, you know, you should embrace life to the fullest, which I think is very positive.
It's also an observation I've not heard before, so I invite you, please, come up to my website, send that to me. I'd love to do a little bit further research on it. In the next couple of weeks, I'm planning to include a whole new section on my website of songs that begin with the word "if." If I had a hammer, and so please consider sending that one to me, would you?
I will. Thank you very much, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Kurt. Good to have you on. Some of these, you have a whole book on Viva la Repartee and clever comebacks, and some of them, of course, are pretty cutting, and some of them are very funny. Aphorisms can hit really low, too. Tallulah Bankhead on Betty Davis: "If I ever get my hands on that hag, I'll tear every hair out of her mustache." This is a little too close to home. Truman Capote: "If you stay in California, you lose 1 point of IQ every year." But,
absolutely.
Aphorisms have those kind of effects, too.
Well, I mean, sometimes they're just absolutely remarkable. Molly Ivins, you remember her. This wonderful Northern girl who moved to Texas, and she becomes one of the only ultra-liberals in this conservative state. She was writing for the Dallas Morning News when she did an article about a Texas politician, and she said, "If his IQ slips any lower, we'll have to water him twice a day."
And then there's that line that's in your book about from John Cleese of Monty Python about Dan Quayle. But if the world were honest and fair, words to that effect, he would be asking, "Do you want fries with that?"
Indeed. That was brutal, wasn't it?
John is our next caller. John, join us. I'm sorry, it's Lee from Portola Valley. Hi, Lee.
Hi. My question is if he's noticed whether there are specific cultures or languages in which there are more or less of these aphorisms.
I have not noticed that, and in fact, when Americans and English speakers read wonderful quotations from the past, whether they come from Nietzsche or from Aristotle or from Cahil Gibran. Or almost all of these observations were originally written in some other language, so we're just reading the English translation. But I think that this tendency to think in a hypothetical manner is really a universal trait, shows up in every language in the world.
Well, it shows up in proverbs and folklore and all those kinds, and myth, of course, as well. In just about every culture, really, doesn't it?
Indeed.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Lee, for the call. And now we'll bring John on. Hi, John.
Hi there. I wanted to give you the unabridged version of one of the aphorisms you've just mentioned.
Okay.
You said something about be careful. My dad always used to say before he'd see me off to college, he'd say, be good. And if you can't be good, be careful. And if you can't be careful, don't get caught.
Okay, yeah, that goes way back. That saying emerges from Europe maybe 200 years ago. Its original version was, if you can't be chased, be careful.
And did it have something following that? We know.
No, that was it.
That
no,
was it.
I think
okay.
We've just added oodles to it over the years.
Yeah, I remember Chase Makes Waste. That was a button in the '60s. Sort of getting back to that whole free love type of notion.
That's all, and it's parodies. One of the fascinating one day I'm going to do a book of parodies because I love what happens when we piggyback on other quotations to come up with something even more clever or witty or original than the person that first said it.
Chuck is our next caller. Chuck, you're on. Good morning.
Morning. There's a quote from Jimmy Cagney in Public Enemy just before he served his girlfriend a grapefruit. It's an aphorism. He's kind of making a sarcastic comment on this comment that she made. I wonder if it's in the book.
It is not. And do you happen to remember what it is?
No, I can't remember specifically what it was, but he uses it just before he smacks her with a grapefruit.
I'll definitely be looking that one up. You know, I have a weekly e-newsletter, Michael, called Dr. Marty's Quotes of the Week. Every week I send this out to 10,000 subscribers around the world. And what I'll probably do now is find that quote and maybe at some point share that with my readers. And if, of course, any of your listeners would like to subscribe, all they have to do is come up to my website and there's a fairly easy link to sign up for the newsletter.
Great, thank you.
And thank you for that call. You want to give out your website again?
www.drmardy.com, and that's drmardy.com.
And again, our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786 if you'd like to bring up a question or comment on aphorisms. If you have something you'd like to contribute, we welcome your call. You can also join us by email, forum@kqed.org, and you can now leave questions and comments on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And one of our callers left an aphorism from a book about Shakespeare by Mark Van Doren. If Shakespeare's plays had not been easy to write, they would have been impossible.
Ooh, isn't that nice?
And let's go to Roberto. Good morning.
Hi there. I've been looking for a quote, and I hope you can tell me. It's one of my favorites, and it's been a mystery, and I don't know how else to trace it. You're my last hope. Here comes.
Okay.
Those who know really know that those who don't know really don't know.
Well,
it's not an aphorism.
The answer is I don't know the author of that. The theme that's being played around with there is fairly common. If you come up to my website, pose the question to me, I promise you I will do some research on that quotation and I'll get back to you. And I have a feeling I'll be able to track it down.
Sure, that too. I'm really happy for you guys.
Hey, well,
thank you for the call. Talking about insults again, you made me think of this with Molly Ivins. There's a whole section here about, well, people being hit for their lack of intelligence. If brains were taxed, she'd get a rebate. If he were any smarter, you could teach him to fetch, and so it goes. If stupidity were a crime, he'd be on the 10 most wanted list. So many having to do with lack of intelligence, stupidity.
And that's true. And those are, again, some of the light ones. Mark Twain said, if Bret Hart ever repaid a loan, the incident has failed to pass into history.
Right.
Now, that's another nicely phrased insult, and it's one of his best, I think.
And here's Andrew. Good morning, Andrew.
Yeah, hi. I have one from George Carlin. It is, if you can't beat them, arrange to have them beaten.
That's a perfect parody, and I've got that in the book as well.
Yeah, I got that from his 365-day calendar. I kept it just because it was so good.
Carlin was a master of taking these popular sayings and then twisting them with his own unique edge.
And I thank you for that, Andrew. Looking at some of the emails here, John says, well, this is less enlightened, but my favorite is if you show me yours, I'll show you mine. I think someone butchered the chemistry joke. If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the precipitate. And that's from Bill. And Rowan writes, when I was young, a man handed me a card with an aphorism he said was one of his father's sayings. It has stuck with me my whole life. If you think you are green, you'll grow. When you think you're ripe, you'll begin to get rotten.
Yeah, interesting. And, well, you know, this happens with quotations is that, you know, they have a staying power. Every book that I've written now in the last 6 or 7 years, I've got a chapter on the theme of words to live by. And some of these aphorisms in that chapter are absolutely wonderful. Albert Einstein said, if you want to live a happy life, tie it to a goal, not to people or to objects. I mean, that's just a wonderful mantra that would benefit many people. Virginia Woolf said, if you do not tell the truth about yourself, you cannot tell it about other people. I mean, these are just nice little reminders of the way in which we, if we were leading our lives effectively, we should lead them.
Jason, thank you for waiting. Join us on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Wonderful subject. I've got one that I heard from an Army chaplain. Sitting down and a long day of briefings, and he started his, he finished his with this. He said, if you can't be good, be brief. If you can't be brief, be gone.
Ah, yes. That's another version of that is if you can't be brief, be seated. But I think that's really nice. And you remember that after all these years, right?
I still remember that one.
They do stay with you if your memory doesn't go. Thank you for the call, Jason. And on we go to Sonia. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call. I have a question with regards to technology in correlation to these literary arts. We've seen the increased usage of Twitter, social media, the embrace of short-form writing. I'm curious to know, what do you think the impacts of this are on aphorisms, particularly in relation to the younger generation?
Oh, wow. What a heavy-duty question. I'm not sure I can answer that in a couple of seconds. I do know the thought that's just kind of coming to my mind is that, you know, the internet and the World Wide Web and all this technology has just mushroomed the abundance of quotations that exist in the world for people to look at. But, you know, the sad reality is that every time I go to a quotation site and I look at these 500 or 600 quotations, about 20% of them, in my opinion, are in error. You know, there's a slight a misspelling or a misphrasing or a misattribution. So when people rely on the internet for the as their only source of quotations, I think they're playing with danger because so many of them are in error.
And we thank you for the call, Sonia. There's a whole chapter in your book called Not So Iffy Advice, and some of it is really quite to the point. If you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything. Or if you want to be thought a liar, always tell the truth. Those kinds of very sharply... Well, they're notional, but at the same time, they also kind of try to get right to the core of things, don't they?
Or Miss Manners. Judith Martin said, if you can't be kind, at least be vague.
Let me go to Oakland, and we'll hear from Eve. Hi, Eve.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Welcome.
I think I have one that's original, but I'm not
Ooh.
Sure. Maybe out there somewhere else. If I had it to do over again, I'd probably just mess it up differently.
Now, let me say to you, Eve, please send that to me.
Okay.
In my newsletter, every week I have a section called Subscriber Quote of the Week. And and every week I take some quotation that some subscriber to my newsletter has sent me, and I immortalize it in my own small way. And so if you would sign up for my newsletter and send me that quotation, I would say there's a very good chance that within a month or two, 10,000 people will be able to know that that is your original creation.
Though there are some like that in here.
Well, there are some like that. But see what Eve's done here, she's taken a very familiar saying and she's just tweaked it in her own way. That's what George Carlin did earlier. So, these qualify as original contributions as well.
Eve, thank you.
You're welcome. Enjoy your day.
Okay. Let me get Michael on. Actually, I think he was going to talk about that song, If I Were a Carpenter and You Were a Lady, which again, for your list of songs that begin with "if," like "If I Had a Hammer,"
indeed that will go up on my website in a couple of weeks. And the other thing I'm going to do on this section of my website, which I think a lot of your listeners will appreciate, is in addition to talking about the song's title and something about the lyrics and the person that sang it, in each case I provide a link to a YouTube video of that song being performed. And I've just had a ball doing the research on it. I just finished it. So bear with me. But anybody who wants to just savor maybe 20 or 25 songs that all have "if" as the first word of the title, it's going to become coming soon and available for your pleasure.
And for our pleasure or our enlightenment, Don is joining us from Boulder Creek. Hi, Don.
Hi. I have a question about the origin of a quote that I like very much and think of often, particularly when I'm watching our American politics. It's, an idea is something you have, an ideology is something that has you.
It's a wonderful observation. It's actually an example of a literary device called chiasmus, which is spelled C-H-I-A-S-M-U-S. And I explored that device in my very first book published 9-10 years ago called Never Let a Fool Kiss You or a Kiss Fool You. I don't know the author offhand of that saying. Again, I know what I'll do after we finish this meeting here. I'll go back home and start doing some research on it. If you drop me a note, that will give me your email address. I'll be able to get back to you on who I think is the original author.
Okay, I will. Thank you. The website is Dr. Mardy, MARDY.com.
It's MARDY, DRMARDY.com. It's a nickname short for, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the call.
I look forward to finding out the origin if you can find it. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I'll do my best.
There's lots on sex, love, and romance we should mention in this book, too. Burt Reynolds, if a woman thinks she's sexy, she is.
Yes.
Rita Rudner, if a man prepares dinner for you and the salad contains three or more types of lettuce, he is serious. And Kathleen Turner said, if a man doesn't look at me when I walk into a room, he's gay. I actually brought that up when she was interviewed by me a number of years
ago.
Really? Yeah, she was.
What did she have to say about it?
She said, I was just kidding around, of course. I think maybe she's a little bit embarrassed by it. Kurt Vonnegut said, if somebody says, I love you to me, I feel as though I had a pistol pointed at my head.
Wow.
Peter Ustinov, if you get on well out of bed, half the problems are better solved. There you go.
I begin that chapter on sex, love, and romance by talking about a couple of really fascinating anecdotes from the history of Willie Nelson. In his autobiography, he said, if I don't do it every day, I get a headache. And there's a couple of neat little stories about Willie there that I think people who are fans of his will appreciate.
Well, I also like Fran Lebowitz. If you can stay in love for more than 2 years, you're on something. Or she also said, if your sexual fantasies were truly of interest to others, they would no longer be fantasies.
talking about sex, love, and romance and going back to song lyrics, I don't know if you remember the Bellamy Brothers, but they were a group that was popular back in the late 70s and 80s, and they did a song that was titled, If I Said You Had a Beautiful Body, Would You Hold It Against Me?
Yes.
That became a number one hit in England, by the way, which is fascinating.
Phil is with us next. Phil, join us.
Yes. I have a question about using an aphorism for people who always criticize liberals. Everywhere you hear people saying, liberals, oh, you're just a liberal, you're just a liberal. And one response I have to a friend who voted for George Moscone, he was liberal many years ago, and I said, well, if it weren't for liberals, we wouldn't have Medicare, we wouldn't have Social Security. Are there any aphorisms that apply politically to try and convince people of this lack of wisdom of their strongly held beliefs?
Well, I've got a whole chapter on politics, and you know, I try to be fair-minded about this and presenting some people from both the left and the right hand. Do you remember the title of the book that Ann Coulter wrote when she said, if Democrats had brains, they would be Republicans? Well, that led to another book by a Democrat that said, if Republicans had a heart, they'd be Democrats. So this business of you using if-erisms to put down or offer your political viewpoint, it's fairly common on both sides of the fence.
What about the antithesis to the old, you know, if you're a liberal when you're young, you're a conservative when you're older or after you've been mugged or whatever?
I tell the story behind that quote in the book as well. It's a fascinating one. Maybe takes a little bit too much longer to hear to get into it, but
is there a counterpoint to it or a counter aphorism?
You know, I'm not aware of one offhand.
Because I think the caller was looking for something along those lines. Let me go to another caller. Alan's joining us from Los Altos. Alan, welcome.
Oh, hi! Great topic. Mose Allison, the jazz pianist. Came
Indeed.
To mind. If silence was golden, you couldn't raise a dime. He had
That's a new one.
Yeah, he had something else. Something. If it was a crime, then something else. It was in that same song, but I can't remember it right now.
I'll definitely be researching that one. Thank you so much.
The name of the song, by the way, is Your Mind is on Vacation and Your Mouth is Working Overtime. So I suspect Mose is probably a great source. You know, he's very witty songwriter.
I'll definitely explore that. He was quite a guy.
Yeah, thank you, Alan. In fact, Steve has something about if frogs had wings. I thought it was if pigs had wings.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead,
yes,
Steve.
Yes, this one is, I must use a different word but rather than when it begins with A, but it goes, if frogs had wings, they wouldn't bump their posteriors when they jump.
Oh.
Yes, and that is the correct version of it.
What's the one about if pigs have wings? So.
Yeah, and I also have something that's close to one of those cutting remarks from Shakespeare, from Timon of Athens, almost an if. It's, were I like thee, I'd throw away myself.
Ooh, now that is very nice, and also a new one for me. Thank you.
Yeah,
another one from Henry the Fourth. If the cook helped to make the gluttony, you helped to make the diseases.
Are you an Elizabethan?
No, but I pay attention to these things.
Yeah, no, you got.
If you'd like me to put those, point those up to the website, I'll do so then.
Please.
Yeah, you'd like them. By all means, and thank you for that. A few more by email. If a man utters anything at all while he's in a forest and there's no woman there to hear it, is he still wrong? If everybody agrees, something must be wrong. That's from Frank. If you can't tell the truth, lie badly, from Lee. And if brains were dynamite, he couldn't blow his nose, from Casey. Thank you, Marty. Good to have you on.
Oh, Michael, thank you so much. It's always a delight to talk to you.
Marty Grothy, Iferisms, and on Tuesday we'll talk to the editors of a book on six-word memoirs. If you have one, or if you want to make up one, or if you want to find out more about it, can sum up your life in six words, visit our kqed.org/forum website.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.